Hello, we're back again. This is episode 41 of Read Comics.
Live from the Read Comics Studios.
Much delays.
It was the holidays, whatever.
Well, and Mike took a while to decide on his
pick. I did announce it, but people didn't listen to me.
For like 3 or 4 months.
The last one was in December. This is kind of like a par for our regular...
So this is a book club edition episode, and we are reading and talking about The Unwritten.
And we are Florence,
Jason,
Mike,
Marty, and
Susie
via Skype. We're confining our discussion, at least for the first half of this podcast, to the trade paperback, which is all that Susie's read.
Which is issues 1 through 5.
Right.
That is our attempt anyway. We'll see how successful we are.
So the latest issue that has actually been released was issue 9.
Which concludes the second arc of the series.
Right. So we will be doing further discussion on that in the second half of the podcast. So those who have only read the first trade paperback can just stop at that point.
Right. And we'll announce that loudly at the time.
No.
It is worth noting that issue 10 comes out this Wednesday.
Which starts a whole new arc.
Right.
Yeah.
Ah.
So,
well, it's possible that it will be another kind of...
It could be an interlude.
Interlude issue, like issue 5 was the Kipling issue.
I hope not.
I kind of hope not too, but yeah, it's easily possible. Since they did put one interlude between the two arcs.
Yeah.
Yep. They could certainly put another one.
The Unwritten... is written by Mike Carey and drawn by Peter Gross, who are probably most well known for their collaboration on the run of Preacher, which they did.
And also
Preacher.
On Lucifer.
Wait, no, Lucifer. I'm sorry, not Preacher.
I was going to say, Preacher is
You're right.
Completely different.
Crap. Edit that out in post-production. Because I meant to say Lucifer. I meant to say Lucifer.
If we edited out all mistakes, I think we'd have much shorter podcasts.
Yeah, it'd be 10 minutes. The reason why I chose Unwritten was mostly because we had never done a Vertigo book before.
Mm.
Really?
Yeah.
No, our first one was Vertigo. Northlanders.
Edit that out as well, by the way.
I can see how you would have forgotten it. Was a very long time
it
ago.
It was a very long time ago.
And I'm going to have to edit out Mike when he says, and Mike, in the beginning of the podcast.
Anything I say, just edit me out.
And it would be very surprising to me that we hadn't done Vertigo before because, I mean, Vertigo are some of the best comics that are really out there.
Have we done anything else besides Northlanders? Have we done anything else Vertigo?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't remember. But, again,
I say nay. Maybe
they are like some of the best comics that are out there right now, I think.
Some of them.
Yeah. Well, what else?
Well, nothing else that we've...
I was just going to say, like, what... I mean, you're saying there's some of the...
What
else is Vertigo doing?
Fables yeah.
And Jack of Fables, and they did Why the Last Man.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not giving them credit in my head for all of these.
Well, the thing is that Vertigo is... It's owned by DC. It's an imprint from DC. But they're kind of like pet projects for each of the creators that they just, you know...
It sort of sprang out of Sandman.
Yeah,
Sandman
is definitely... Sandman and Swamp Thing, and I think Animal Man was moved into the Vertigo line at the
Animal
time.
Animal Man was moved
they started
Vertigo.
Being published just by DC in general, and then DC sort of noticed that they had this whole market of people buying things like Swamp Thing and Sandman and decided to start an imprint to make more things like that without having to integrate it into the DC universe.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And they used to do a lot more with their characters, their main characters, like Animal Man. In the DC universe, in Vertigo Comics. They don't really do that anymore.
Well, actually, they've kind of been going back towards that a little bit with Madame Xanadu and House of Mystery.
Okay.
Where Madame Xanadu has the various mystical characters, the Phantom Stranger and the Demon and all those showing up. And, I mean, mostly what they're doing with Vertigo is they're telling stories that are more meaty, so to speak. Definitely more adult themed. There's swearing, for sure.
Is there swearing in this comic?
Yeah. That's really the only adult thing, though, that I found.
Yeah, it's
in
not really
this comic?
Really.
In this comic? What else?
Well, there's murder.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
Yeah, but that happens in every comic book, no matter what. I saw that in the Mickey Mouse comic once. No, I mean, if it just murder, that doesn't separate.
Well,
it's really go from the regular DC universe.
In
well, yeah, I mean, there are definitely things I feel like are a hallmark of Vertigo, although I must admit, mainly it's the hallmark of the stuff I read from Vertigo, which is the fantasy elements, the literary elements, like they are incorporated in this book. So the stuff that I always read from Vertigo were things like Sandman and Books of Magic and Lucifer, Fables now The Unwritten, and Why the Last Man is probably the furthest away from what I normally associate with Vertigo, but is still Vertigo.
I agree with you in that respect. If Vertigo represents a certain tone of comic, a certain you know, genre of comic, then yes, Unwritten definitely falls into that. If it's just an adult-oriented comic, I think they could have taken away the swear words and still published it under a non-Vertigo title.
Mm-hmm. And well, the thing is,
Jason's right. Some of the...
But they do produce a whole bunch of other stuff that has nothing to do with it. They also did Preacher...
Yeah.
They did Transmetropolitan.
But both of those are very adult-oriented comics,
yeah.
though. Preacher, really. I mean, that was written, what, by Garth Ennis? Is that right?
Yeah.
And I would say that the murder in this, at least in the first half, is a lot more gruesome than what you would find in most of the...
probably.
I mean, they essentially have a horror movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, especially in...
Oh, yeah. You're right about that.
The fourth
issue.
Right, I mean, Sandman was godless and was intellectually geared towards grown-ups, but it wasn't as, I think, gruesome as this.
Right. It was something that probably wouldn't serve. I mean, for a long time it was published under the DC line, not Vertigo, right?
Yeah.
So, but did it change its tone when they went to Vertigo? Like,
you know,
I think it was just sort of a natural progression rather than, you know, oh, now I'm working for, you know, now we've got this imprint. I think it's just, it did change tones as it went on, but I think that was just because that's where the story was going, rather than...
Yeah.
I really ought to finish Sandman someday.
Yes.
It's
worth it.
But to be honest, Unwritten probably wouldn't have been the first thing that I chose to podcast about for my choice. It was, but the other ones I wanted to choose wasn't at a good point to do that at. And,
I'm
certainly pleased with the choice, but at the time when I had to make the choice, I still had only read the first two issues because I couldn't find the third issue.
Uh-huh.
So I hadn't gotten really too attached to the book at that point, but I am kind of attached now. It is a very good book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I liked the choice. I thought it was an awesome choice. I had actually, before you even suggested it, had bought the trade.
Oh, okay.
So cool. We were all kind of on the same page, I think.
When I was reading it, though, I was thinking this would be a hard one to podcast about because, especially in the first arc, I wasn't really quite sure what the book was about.
Mm.
It was tough to really define, I think. What do you guys think?
Really? I think it's pretty clearly defined.
I think it is much more clearly now that we've read the second arcs without spoiling anything. I think it's more clear, but...
What did you say, Susie?
Well, should we give a brief description of... The basic plot?
I was about to suggest that.
Okay.
I think, you know, mainly it's about this guy, Tom.
Tommy. Tommy, what's his last name?
Taylor,
okay.
Tom Taylor.
A.K.A. Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty much. He is Harry Potter, even though they reference Harry Potter in the first issue.
Yeah. I mean...
So, anyway, Tom
Taylor is the son of the guy who wrote the series of children's books that feature prominently this guy, Tommy Taylor. And
a,
so,
a kid.
Right, he's
a kid. A kid
and
wizard.
He's essentially Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And he has
a wizard, black hair, glasses.
Yeah.
Goes to magic school.
Has, you know, two companions, another little boy and a girl.
Yep.
He doesn't have a scar. He has a tattoo.
He has a flying cat.
He doesn't have an owl. He's got a flying cat.
The chosen one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He's
yeah.
got a wand.
And he has a nemesis.
He has
yes.
a nemesis who, in this book, is...
Count Ambrosio.
He's sort of a
vampire-like
yeah, character.
Vampire.
But he's not the, like, hot, young, sexy vampire. He's more the vampire of the Nosferatu.
Right. He's like, rah!
Holy crap, I was ripped off.
You paid full
I
price
paid,
for
I
it.
Paid a 99 cents more for my issue than you did for yours, for your number one. What the fuck is that all about? Just because my cover's black and yours is white. I didn't know
black
that.
Black one is cooler. Yeah.
Mm. Vertigo, to explain what we've been talking about, Vertigo has been doing a lot to drum up business lately by putting out the first issues
for
a dollar.
Yeah. In fact, I noticed a little blurb about that in their monthly column.
So it's a reprint back to normal price? Is that
No, I think this was just a more limited edition type one, I think.
Hmm.
I don't know. Because they came out at the same time, because you could choose between the white or the black one.
Uh-huh.
And you chose poorly.
What did you say, Susie?
99 cents, I don't think it's going to break the bank.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean,
I know I get the black one forever.
Yeah, you're
so...
Plus you get this giant
getting back
blurb.
To the plot, there's these immensely popular books about a character named Tommy Taylor, and then there's the man, Tom Taylor, who... It's pretty much been decided that his father based the character Tommy Taylor on him.
Yeah.
And,
right, so he's...
But he's very cynical about the whole legacy of his father, and that even though
how
he's living off
he
of it,
do we think
yeah.
he is?
I think he's
20s, somewhere
early
in the 20s.
20s.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the story picks up when he has essentially been abandoned by his father quite a few years before.
Yeah,
and
the
no, and in
well,
fact,
his
father
disappeared.
Has,
they
right.
don't know. Nobody knows why he's disappeared or where he is. There's no, you know. Probably presumed
Tom
dead,
feels
but
that his father just you know
abandoned him.
Picked up
yeah.
and abandoned him. He doesn't think there's anything suspicious. He just thinks his father ditched him.
And
yeah.
the fact that his father had written this beloved series and that he shares a name with the main character makes him sort of a minor celebrity, but he really doesn't enjoy that at all.
He doesn't
so he
enjoy being associated
tours.
With it, but he kind of lives off of it.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of clear that like other people sort of resent him for just living off of his father's celebrity.
Well,
but
other authors.
Other authors.
Other authors, other, you know...
People in
but,
the industry.
But there is definitely a fanatical following for
yeah.
these books and this character.
To carry on the Harry Potter analogy, like, just imagine had J.K. Rowling actually had a kid named Harry.
Yeah.
You know, there would be an intense, you know... spotlight on this kid,
right.
interest in this kid.
It's
well,
true.
And I wonder, though, if some of the resentment that he feels isn't just because, you know, people are like, oh, you're Tommy Taylor, but the thing he keeps bringing up in the first issue is that his father abandoned him when he was, you know, still
and
in single digits.
Not
yes.
just abandoned him, but also he got no... he was not able to... get any of the money. He wasn't able to get at
his
because
he wasn't
estate.
Declared dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a there's legal entanglements with claiming his inheritance. And
so and like, that's part of the reason he has to make a little living.
Right.
You see what it is. He doesn't have, it's not just, oh, I want to be famous.
He could
have
gone
it's,
to school and become an architect or
money
something.
To live, and he doesn't seem to have any other skills. Or any that have worked out.
That's the big thing, is that he chose not to get any other skills.
Right.
I think there is definitely something of a slacker, you know, I deserve the world handed to me. I
he's got a
have,
chip on his shoulder.
He's got, yeah, definitely.
Well, and that actually is a reference to a other literary character.
Mm.
Yeah.
Christopher Robin.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, Christopher Robin from the Winnie the Pooh books is based on A. Mellon's son, Christopher Robin. And he grew up to really resent that. Not only just to be associated with this, you know, angelic, sweet child that he doesn't really remember being. And all the toys from the books are actual toys he had. But he was so young, he doesn't really remember doing any of that, or if he did at all. And then also he sort of feels like his father had co-opted him and used him to create something to sell.
Wow, I did not know that.
Wow, that is interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
Hmm.
But I still love those books.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, Marvel should really do a Winnie the Pooh series with John by Scotty Young. Cool. Anyway, so Tommy or Tom is at this, yeah, don't call him Tommy, he'll get mad at that. Tom is at a convention speaking when he's blindsided by somebody who is claiming that he is not who he says he is. That he is not actually the son of the author who wrote these books, which totally takes him by surprise, and he believes that he is.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right. But she has this evidence that his the equivalent of a social security number wasn't originally his; it was from a woman who died,
mm-hmm.
and that there are people who claim they were his parents, and that. The author basically bought or gave them money to let him use the kid to drum up publicity, and
yeah.
then never gave him back.
So now, based on that one claim by the one person, the entire world is now against him. And
which,
nobody,
you know,
believes him and hates him. Everyone hates him now.
That happens all the time.
Yeah,
some,
it's true. There's
yeah,
definitely...
starts up on the internet about anybody
mm-hmm.
remotely famous, and people are going to latch onto that and believe it.
Well, especially because there had been this whole, you know, affection and identification with him, you know, on the part of people, and so they felt personally betrayed that somehow that wasn't genuine, even though he never really claimed to be what they were attached to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They do play a lot with the idea of public perception and how easily swayed it can be, and how fanatical people can be with certain books and characters that we talked about already, and just basically how they feel they have ownership
mm-hmm.
of that and are owed a certain thing by the people who created those or have anything associated with it.
Yeah, I mean, to bring us a bit out of the analysis of the story or the description of the story, and into analysis of the book, one of the things I really thought was interesting about this was how often they use, like, a page full of, you know, news clippings
or
news reportings.
Or internet
or like,
blogs or something
yeah,
like that.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly, where there'll be a whole page full of, like, little blog clippings and IM conversations. And
it's kind of a way, I think, the author uses to tell you what has been going on in between scenes, you know, what the public is saying, what the perception is, just they give little tidbits of news and then how people react to it.
But no, you know, and I think part of that is also rather than having a this is what happened in past issues page,
mm.
this is their way of contextualizing that
sure.
into the story itself. If you missed the previous issues, this will kind of tell you a little bit about what happened.
An interesting way to do exposition.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and that happens a lot in the first issue, too. I mean, when there's nothing previous
yeah.
at all.
Well,
so, I mean,
it's still exposition. It still brings
right.
you to that universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, continuing with the plot, he gets kidnapped by somebody who believes he is Count Ambrosio. Somebody who they later find out has a history of mental illness. Kidnaps him, is going to publicly kill him via webcam at the Globe Theater,
which
was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, like, how did he get into the Globe Theater?
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of a webcam, and yeah.
And then is set up by the same person who outed him as not being the son of the guy.
Right, she comes in, she saves him.
She saves him and sets it up so it looks like that Ambrosio was killed, but he wasn't. Therefore, he must really be Tommy.
Right. Well, Ambrosio was going to set off a bomb. She comes up and saves Tommy, lets the bomb go off. Ambrosio dies. And then Tommy, who was just sort of knocked out but fine, she makes it look like he was right in the blast, but survived without a scratch.
Yes. Well, some scratches, maybe.
But. Right, yeah, actually, like, I kind of got the impression that he was all cut up, but I guess...
Well, he's got the head injury from when he was hit on the head, but I think that's really the only major injury. He might have minor lacerations,
but... takes him, like, a box cutter and cuts up his clothes. So
yeah.
Like,
to show that it was a nail bomb or something like that. So the clothes were
like
shredded from the...
Shrapnel, yeah. But didn't actually get hurt.
Yeah.
But and what all this is supposed to show is that stories are powerful, which we then find out in the fifth issue, which is an interlude issue, which is not part of the main story, but kind of a background of the universe, that there is this faction, this cabal, who is charting the course of fiction throughout the ages to their own ends because fiction has power.
Yes.
And their ends do seem to be material and related to the politics or, you know, economy of the time, but they're using stories to further whatever those purposes are in the real world.
Yep.
One thing I didn't care for at the end of the first issue, and that kind of led into the second issue, and became... We talked a little bit about the whole public perception. I found it a little bit hard to believe that everybody, at the conclusion of the first issue, instantly believed that he was, in fact, the person from the novels and had all these powers. I found that far-fetched. That there was no other possible explanation for his survival at the bomb, other than the fact that, oh my god, he's little Harry Potter in flesh.
Well, that happened actually, though, before. That happened right after she outed him or said, like, you know, you're not actually this dude's son. Like, one of the news reactions was, like, this whole, there's a guy who's actually, like, kind of a preacher.
That guy that was head of that cult in New Zealand,
right?
But he definitely looked like he was being passed off as a really out of his mind fanatic too. I mean, he was in rags, he had long stringy gross hair.
Yeah, but he comes back. I mean, essentially, he becomes the leader of this whole movement that believes that he is Tommy, and he's definitely in the second issues and stuff.
Was he?
Yeah.
The impression I got was not that, you know, suddenly everybody believed that, but
there's a growing
number
faction
of people who started to believe that. And since these books were so immensely popular and everybody around the world was believing that, you know, even the small portion of the readership that would believe that is still pretty big.
It's interesting that I believe that there is a real indictment of the fan community in this as well.
Oh yeah,
the way that they turn on him in that first issue. You know, everyone loves him. They think he's Tommy Taylor,
right?
And everyone loves him until there's this story that just, you know, comes up in a convention. You know, Lizzie person who is saying, hey, you're not really Tom
Lizzie
Taylor.
Hexham, right?
Lizzie Hexham. You're not really Tommy Taylor. There was no Tommy Taylor, all this, and I have proof. All of a sudden, everyone believes her. And that, I had a little bit of trouble with that, you know, that if we go to a lot of science fiction conventions, and if someone popped up like that, they would be booed off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I had a little bit of trouble with that aspect of it.
And yet, like, I think about things like that have actually happened, like before even the internet. There's, you know, about the Fatty Arbuckle scandal.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Somewhat we call that, but
there was a silent film star named Fatty Arbuckle. He was bigger than, you know, not just in size, but like more famous than Chaplin. He was
immensely popular.
And he had a party at his house one day, and a woman died at the party. And there was absolutely no evidence that he was involved in any way, but people implied that he was, and his career was ruined, and he basically died destitute many years later because of this. And it's been proved over and over again that, in fact, she just choked on a piece of food, and she didn't even know he had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
But that one little germ, well, she's at his house, and now she's dead. Like, that ruined him forever.
It's so funny,
like,
because...
the story was that, you know, he sacrificed her in a cult thing or something. It just got, you know, more and more strange and bizarre, and it just ruined him.
Hmm.
And that was before the ending.
Yeah, well, that also, the way that the public can be swayed so easily also comes to, makes me come... reminds me of the whole story about when the original radio broadcast of War of the Worlds by Orson Welles, which made a lot of people think we really were being invaded by aliens. That
the power of stories.
Yeah.
That's what they're talking
exactly.
about here.
It's hard to believe that today it would be that likely that people would fall for it that easily, but...
I don't know. I mean, there have been the internet rumors about people dying in weird ways that, like,
yeah, but
keep getting believed. And
I mean,
debunked.
More of like out of this world type stuff, like magic existing and aliens invading and that kind of stuff.
Right. I mean, I get the impression that we were saying, you know, some small subset of fandom was buying into it.
Yeah.
I think that was the same small subset that was probably inclined towards getting overly attached to him in the first place,
yeah.
and then was briefly disillusioned by the scandal, and then their, you know, belief was strengthened by this other event.
Also, we're seeing, you know, the reports on this on the news for the most part, and the news isn't going to be in, you know, like, and we're going to interview the, you know, 80% of fans of this novel who aren't paying any attention at all.
Right.
I'm very curious as to why Lizzie Hexham did what she did in the first place, because it doesn't really seem to coincide with anything else she's done in the rest of the series.
Well, that's the thing, is we didn't really mention, there definitely seem to be forces pulling strings.
Yeah.
About what gets released and when. And clearly she is being directed by someone to first out him as being a fraud, to create doubt, and then I think she's also being directed this one I'm not clear on whether she does this on her own or not, but somebody wants people believing that he really is Tommy Taylor.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, it put both her on the map by doing the original stunt, and it got him in the news cycle so that the next news cycle would have even more play.
But she admits she screwed up by doing that in the first place.
Well, here's a question.
Well, she feels bad, I think. She feels bad, but, like, she's clearly been directed, she doesn't, and then she feels bad that he is now been so negatively affected by it.
I think that there's some question as to whether... I mean, we don't know a whole lot about Tommy Taylor's history. We know that he was a child that lived in Wilson Taylor's house. You know,
Wilson Taylor was his father, whether he was or he wasn't.
Yeah, we don't know if Wilson Taylor was his father. We don't know any of this stuff. There is some question that is he a fictional character come to life?
Right, well, and he doesn't seem to have a lot of specific memories about his childhood one way or the other.
So, you know, there is all that. But when he goes to find out about Lizzie at the university wherever it is she's supposed to work, he finds out that her name is actually the name of a character from Dickens. So, is she a fictional character?
Well, and I think...
The flying cat is...
Bingus has paid us a visit.
Yes.
Yes, so there's a flying cat in the Tommy Taylor books, and at the very end of the first arc, it just appears.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in our household, a very clumsy cat just fell over something.
And almost knocked over a glass of water, but
and
didn't.
It's fighting with a blanket.
Yeah, now he's like, he blames the blanket for what just happened to him, even though it was his own clumsiness.
But he's afraid it's like going to attack him or something.
Yeah, he's biting the blanket now.
And flinching at the blanket's inertness.
He's clearly trying to distract us.
So there is that, you know, what in this story is real and what is fiction?
Mm-hmm.
Right,
and actually, does it make a difference?
Because we've been talking, like, you know, he isn't Tommy Taylor, he is just this dupe, but I think there's a lot more to it.
Well, one
and
thing
he might actually be Tommy Taylor or something.
One thing we do know about Tommy Taylor, which is apparently very significant, is that he has this uncanny knowledge of, and he was actually raised this way by his father, this knowledge of where things were written. He doesn't necessarily know much about the stories. I mean, he does. He's demonstrated that he knows pretty well about a lot about literature, but he especially knows the history of the places where things were written.
Not just written,
or he just knows about places set. In relation
or settings,
to literature.
Yeah.
If something was written there, or if something, if a location was written about in a book, significantly or based on a real location in a book, it's just, yeah.
Right.
That's true. And he refers that to that knowledge as, like, you know, the only thing his father passed down to him.
Yeah. They, at the end of the second issue, he's, you know, trying to find out the answers to his heritage. So, takes him to the place where he was raised, which happens to be the same mansion that where Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. Came up with the idea for Frankenstein. There's also a connection to John Milton and Paradise Lost in there.
And, yeah, we haven't gotten into sort of what happens at the mansion yet.
Yeah.
Which
but he goes there to find his father's old housekeeper.
Yes.
To see if she has any answers for him.
And he finds that there's this, like, sort of a writer's group that's meeting, or a writing workshop
A horror writer's
and
group.
And it's horror.
they're kind of, it's a little pilgrimage to the birthplace of Frankenstein.
Right. And there's, like, five authors, and it sounds like they're all, well, they're published anyway.
Some are published, some are
aspiring.
Kind of more internet, some are more, like, slash writers.
Well, and they kind of have analogs. I mean, the only one who I was really able to place was vampire
Laurel Hamilton.
Yeah, that basically she was Laurel K. Hamilton.
Yeah. Yeah, that one was definitely obvious.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure that the others have analogs as well, but
I would be surprised if there weren't.
Not necessarily a specific person, but just certain trends in horror.
Yeah,
right?
Actually, that was my impression, because I don't think Laura K. Hamilton is the only one.
No, but
she's
the most
prominent person writing, which again,
Anita Blake.
Nobody else knows. Laura K. Hamilton writes a couple of different series, but her most prominent one is the Anita Blake series. Which is ostensibly about, I can't even speak today, about a detective who works in a world where vampirism has become legalized, and she gets involved with several vampires, and the whole series just, every book seems to be about placing her in bed with different supernatural creatures. And it's definitely erotica. Although I've read a couple of the books, and they're so not my cup of tea.
They're very schizophrenic. I mean, it seems to me that she doesn't know whether she's writing mystery stories, horror stories, or softcore porn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the first couple like are more actual, feel like books with some sex in it, and then the rest just are sex. And ridiculously detailed descriptions of what people are wearing. And if you try to visualize the descriptions of these clothes, it's just the worst clothes you've ever heard of.
the person in the comic here that they have to represent Laurel K. Hamilton, I don't know how she looks in real life, but the character kind of looks like the Marvel comic adaptation of Anita Blake herself, so that's kind of where I saw that analogy also.
Yeah, but so there's, besides this analogy, there's a guy who writes torture porn.
Yeah.
Let's see what else.
Who, like, even though the genre doesn't bear any resemblance, in personality reminded me of Warren Ellis.
Yeah. I definitely can see that.
Like,
so, I mean, Warren Ellis, I mean, in personality, yes, but I don't think Warren Ellis writes torture porn at all. I mean,
but he's got the same attitude.
And he's definitely, like, very unabashed about the torture that he does put in. You know,
true.
I think
he relishes, you know, making people squirm.
Well, yeah, I mean, do you remember that portion. He did that reading from his prose novel?
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, that pretty much, that could be described as
torture porn
yes. in parts.
What was it? Oh, it was Godzilla. It was,
Yeah.
Yeah, the like Godzilla porn. Like,
yes.
When there's like
more about the injecting the saline.
Yeah, the saline thing was also disgusting, but
the
room full of people.
Thank you for reminding me of that.
That's what we're all sort of shuddering is having seen Warren Ellis live at Wizard World a couple of years back in Chicago. And hearing him he did a reading of a novel that none of us have read.
No, I've read it. I think Jason has too, right?
No, I haven't read
it. Oh, you haven't? Yeah, I read it. It's
I have
called,
no desire to.
What was it called?
I don't care.
I don't know.
We're off topic.
Yes.
But anyway, so yeah, there's the torture porn guy. What else? I'm looking at the page now. So yeah, there's the woman who writes the vampire erotica. Then there's somebody who's writing Lovecraft stories.
Finishing Lovecraft stories.
Yeah, he was kind of been hired to complete them.
It looks like steampunk-esque here. She calls it psychographic magic realist.
But she hasn't been published.
Mm-hmm. Postmodern self-referential slasher horror.
So basically Scream and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Warren Ellis' novel is called Crooked Little Vein.
Okay.
The non Laurel K. Hamilton writers actually seem to me to be less novel writers and more screenwriters. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have basically, you know, people who a guy who makes things like Saw and Hostel and stuff like that, and then we also have a guy who makes Scream and movies of that ilk.
Sure.
But, as
well, yeah. So I think basically he's just packaging these different trends in horror into these different authors.
Yeah, exactly. They're stereotypes.
Okay.
But so it's interesting. So, I mean, I was gonna say, you know. So then I guess I'm gonna spoil it here. But I was gonna say it. So then they all die. They're all murdered violently.
Well, we all know that, and we don't care if anyone listening doesn't know that.
Well, right, that's revealed in issue 4,
so.
Yeah.
Well, we do care. We do care about our listeners. We just
we want
hope
to spoil
that you,
you
had the smarts to know that we were going to reveal that
so
in reviewing these issues.
Right, what's going on in this very famous house, which is also famous in this universe for being where the Tommy Taylor books were written. And Tommy shows up. And suddenly everybody inside gets killed.
Well, he's been...
Except Rick.
He's been followed by this guy with this weird ability to melt people into words.
Melt
things into words.
With his hands.
With his hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they turn into, like, a
that,
puddle of words.
That I'm
word
very,
ectoplasm.
Yeah, and, yeah, they it's,
but
it's
so,
very weird. What do you make of all that?
But here we come to our first inconsistency in the novel.
Yeah.
Or in the story. Because not everything he touches turns into a puddle
that.
Of words.
I
well,
did notice
but
that.
Is he touching things with the wooden hand?
Yeah.
Does he wear a glove on occasion?
The very first... The,
well,
the
why
end,
wouldn't the glove
the very,
then change?
The last page of the very first issue, he is holding something in his wooden hand.
There's... Yes, he is.
Well, okay, so maybe it's not...
But it's a statue of Tommy.
Maybe it's a constant... or it's not a constant, but a conscious thing. He
right.
has to actually...
It's a weapon he has to deploy.
Yeah. Will or something like that.
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe. There was a scene where he encounters the housekeeper and he's threatening her. Like, you know what happens if I touch you with this hand?
Yeah.
There's certainly no reason why it can't be conscious. I mean, he's touching his... He's got his arms folded and touching his
himself.
Jacket.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Why isn't his jacket
good
changing?
Point.
But,
I mean, that was kind of my...
I'm sorry, I just, yeah, like, the scariest bad guy, undone by spontaneous masturbation accident.
Like, what words would that put to? So, I've been reading the little melted puddles and trying to make sense of the words that it melts into, and there doesn't seem to really be any significance that I've been able to figure out.
Well, what do you see?
You can't even
her
really
head.
Out
some of them you can.
Her head, when the housekeeper's head melts, it melts into unanswered questions.
Interesting.
Where'd that put it away?
And you know, this actually, there's a lot of stuff in this that is reminding me of a lot of other things that I've read recently.
I mean, Well of Lost Souls, or Lost Plots.
Yep.
Definitely
Thursday Next novels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jasper Ford is a clear influence here, I think,
yep.
Personally. I mean, I don't know.
Also, The Magicians.
Which I just started reading, and actually I'm having a hard time sorting out in my head of which things I've just read there versus this.
The Magicians is a book by, I'm not remembering the name. It was actually a book that I read for the Galaxians Book Club, which was a suggestion by Bruce Schneier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was his suggestion.
A brief aside, I ran into a page recently that does, like, you know, the jokes that are like, I'm not going to remember.
Susie,
while
Marty's trying to remember this, The Magicians is another Harry Potter analog in a much darker vein.
Uh-huh.
Harry Potter and also Narnia.
And Narnia. Harry Potter and Narnia, where, again, you have a series of books that is very meaningful in the lives of people, and
Lev Grossman.
There's a question is, are these stories real? Are they fiction? And it's very compelling.
And it's on our list of things to send to you as soon as Florence
awesome.
Finishes it.
Yay! Okay. Definitely metafiction is not... This is not, the first word in metafiction, but it's pretty cool. And
also
I have
fables.
Metafiction. I'm totally into that.
You know, this is kind of...
I have not read everything out there.
I'm kind of thinking that, it does not seem unreasonable for there to be a crossover between this and fables at some point.
Huh.
When the sort of publicity for this started coming out for the first issue, there was, they were describing it, and they're talking about, what's real and what's fiction and all these characters, and then there's like, but in no way like fables, in no way is this exactly like fables.
Well, it is interesting thinking that Vertigo is the same, same one that published Books of Magic as well, which was, pre-Harry Potter.
I was very happy to see that they did mention Books of Magic it's specifically when they mentioned Harry Potter and Books of Magic.
And
so
they mentioned something else, too. What was the other thing that they mentioned?
So it says, yes, people have seen similarities with Harry Potter, Books of Magic, The Worst Witch...
Oh, The Worst Witch, okay.
I
have not read that. It's another series of kids' books.
And I was happy to see Books of Magic get a shout-out, because I think that's kind of a forgotten gem from Vertigo. I really loved Books of Magic.
Well, right. It's almost like it's forgotten because it came before Harry Potter, so no one can claim that it was a Harry Potter analog.
Any time after Harry Potter, he mentions it, they're like, Harry Potter ripoff.
Yeah.
But in fact, it predates it by 5, 6, 7 years, I don't know.
And thus ruins any chance of them ever making a movie into it.
Yeah. It was good, though.
Probably, which I'm actually fine with, because, how so few comic book movies actually get the essence of the story right. And,
right. I'm really hoping Sandman never gets made.
Oh, totally.
It would just be so weird and probably much darker than the comic, I think, because the tone of the comic doesn't really match sort of actually happenings in the comic.
Yeah.
It would have to be horror. I mean, it would be,
It would just be so, unironically angsty that it would be unbearable.
And, I mean, even if somebody, Guillermo del Toro did it so reverentially, did it right, there would still be so much that just wouldn't translate. Things like the characters changing with each artist that draws them, or with what's going on, the mood of the scene.
Yeah,
it's just, there's lots of stuff that just wouldn't make it on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about the final issue in the trade, which is an interlude issue, where it kind of sets up this cabal
And it's a story about Kipling. And
which it sounds like you guys were not into, but I actually found it fascinating.
No, it was interesting. I just found it... I thought that was something that they could have presented a little bit later, rather than in its first within its first five issues.
Well, you talked about not knowing what the story was about. I think that was sort of their pronouncement of like, okay, you know, we have these characters, we have this plot, but this is really what this whole thing is about.
Well, other than the fact that they had... They showed the guy with the wooden hand in that story. It didn't really tell us what that has to do with the story going on.
Well, it kind of did in that it introduces or really clarifies the goal of the cabal that's been hanging on the outskirts of Tommy, that they've been around for a long time. That they are way more powerful than, you know, than they even appear in this. And they're very happy to ruin people's life if it, lives if it suits their agenda.
Well, do we know that this cabal is the one that's kind of ruining Tommy's life?
Well, we don't.
I
we
guess.
Don't know whether...
Supposedly, but it seems
supposedly, but I think maybe it has to do with more with the father's disappearance. And I think when... Because we've seen that a mysterious, what is it, 14th book has shown up.
Mm-hmm.
After,
oh, right, yeah.
Supposedly written by the father. So I think
right.
that...
Tommy's been gone for 15 to 20 years. And the series ended at 13, although people feel like there should have been a follow-up book.
Yeah, and apparently there is, and it's just
right.
arrived.
It's
so
out of the blue at his publisher's office shows up a manuscript. The little note from him saying, like, here's the 14th book.
So for all we know, the Cabal could be trying to protect Tommy. You know, maybe...
Well, that's... Yeah, that's... We don't know who is out to get Tommy, who is trying to save Tommy, really, at this point. Because the man with the wooden hand, Pullman is
mm-hmm.
his name, has had opportunities
to
kill Tommy, but hasn't.
Yeah.
Instead, he's done things to...
Yeah.
Put him into certain
right.
places.
And we're certainly led to believe that they're
antagonistic.
It's
protecting him so much as protecting their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does see, you know, you do see him argue with sort of a higher up in the organization who, and the higher up is saying things like, you know, we need to discredit him before we kill him. And, you know, so then like, I expected actually that they were going to try and kill him at the mansion because he was discredited at that point. Like, so, but then it was, but then they didn't.
They're saying that they don't want to kill him because that could prove that he actually is the kid from the book.
If they try and kill
him,
and
it doesn't work, then he is the kid. So we better just keep him alive just to preserve that ambiguity.
Hmm.
And
yeah, it could be taken as a martyrdom, make him even more powerful in people's minds.
Did Wilson, the writer of the books, did he get kidnapped by the Cabal, or did he go into hiding because he decided, as we find in the fifth issue, the way Kipling decided, I'm not going to play ball with the Cabal anymore, and now all these bad things are happening, and then he's like, wait, I know how this works. I'm going to write this last story in order to save my son, which is what Kipling is supposedly having done in this
yes,
last
right.
book, but it was too late. Did Wilson find out the same kind of things? And he's like, you know what? I know what's going on. I understand how this works. I am more powerful than you are.
Well,
you know,
through...
isn't that like the other connection in this story's main narrative is at the very end of the issue, we see Wilson and like, the 60s or 70s, walk into a bookstore and find Kipling's posthumous journal.
Yeah.
Describing all these events that he wasn't, you know, he could never say anything about until, you know, he was at the very end of his life and about to die, and everybody he cared about couldn't
yeah.
be harmed by it.
Yeah, and then he says, but after I'm dead, like, you know,
all
bets
are
off.
Yeah.
And so then that's presumably, we're reading the journal, and he's saying that.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. That's definitely
well,
stuff that still remains to be seen.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because in this issue, And I apologize, I'm not sure exactly where we see this, Susie, but we at some point see Pullman talking to someone else in the Cabal, presumably a leader of the Cabal, and we don't see their face. And
yeah,
it's being deliberately hidden, which to me indicates it's someone we know.
Could be Wilson.
Yeah, it like Wilson comes to mind as, you know.
Also the character of Tom's manager.
I was going to mention that too. My first impression in the first issue was that he was kind of pulling Tommy's strings a bit too. That he was working for whoever it is that wants to discredit
Tom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he encouraged him to get drunk several times and.
Yeah, made plans behind his back.
He's there, he tends to pacify him when Tom's particularly upset.
Keep an eye on him,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. I don't know, there's a lot of possibilities that they haven't fleshed out yet, which.
We see the manager talking on the phone with somebody.
Yeah.
And it could be a member of the Cabal, or it could be just, you know, somebody else. One of, you know, whoever runs his company. Trying to make sure the money train doesn't get derailed.
It really is, like, pretty wide open, even after the ninth issue, like, you know, we don't necessarily know a lot, you know, where it's going. And it's really interesting, I think.
Well, there's definitely more.
And it's from way back in the first issue, is Town Ambrosio, because when we were introduced to him, he's at the panel that Tommy's speaking at, and he's pretty pathetic.
That was kind of funny.
And sad. Looking, you know, he stands up and acts like he's the character from the book, but he's asking very fanish questions.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, so how did you know that Sue Sparrow's tears would burn me in the same way holy water does? And he's, you know, he's acting like a fan, acting, you know.
And it's obviously someone who had been following Tommy around a bit.
But he's saying he's one of the characters. And then security takes him away. There's no threats, he's very pathetic looking and sad, and he looks like a human that's, you know, shaved his head and gotten fangs and stuff. But then the next time we see him, when he actually kidnaps Tom and threatens to blow him up, he's really different.
Yeah,
I wasn't entirely sure that was the same person. It certainly could have been, but it didn't necessarily have to be.
I don't know if it is or not.
Well, did you guys notice that in that issue where he kidnaps Tom, that it almost looks like the manager is in cahoots with him a little bit?
Yep, that was my impression also.
Really?
Yeah, if you look at that issue, when the manager is sending Tom off on his trip,
uh-huh.
it's almost like he knows that the guy is waiting down at the bottom of the stairs.
Well, when Tom hugs him, on their departure and thanking him for everything, there's definitely a look of discomfort.
Yeah, look at that right now. It's definitely that can be implicated, but we don't know.
Yeah,
if it is or not. So yeah, it's totally possible he's working with him. But this other, so one of the Count Ambrosio that kidnaps Tom really looks like a vampire.
Oh yeah, especially.
He really looks evil. Isn't acting like the same guy at all.
In fact, there are scenes where it almost looks like a different artist when they show his face, and that one in particular, I just turned to the one a few pages after his introduction, and his face is right in Tommy's face there at the Globe Theater, and his mouth is wide open. That almost looks like a completely different.
Well, and even, like, looking at his ears, like, here they look pretty normal, and then here they're pointed. And then we look like a few pages later, like they are way pointed.
He's kind of morphing more and more into the character.
Yeah, well, that's my impression too.
Which, you know, could be entirely intentional.
You know, we get the report that this is the same guy from the convention. They found his body. He's been identified as the guy from the convention.
He has
a police record for years of stalking Tommy in that kind of sad, pathetic way that he does.
Well, and maybe he's both. Maybe he is this fan, and maybe he is Count Ambrosio. In this whole way that, are we sure what's real and what's fiction? And is fiction becoming real?
Just, or maybe he was just a sad guy who kind of had a mental break and thought he was this character, and then somehow that was taken advantage of.
That the real, in quotations, Count Ambrogio is able to inhabit him because of this, because he believes that he is the character.
So
it's not ever, we don't know, and I don't know if we'll ever find that out.
Which seems like a really good segue for talking about the second arc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything, Susie, that you'd like to talk about before we have you sign off?
Going back to the final issue, the one with Kipling, I did find this one particularly fascinating, and the whole idea of somebody, of this organization finding authors that have a spark and then, you know, taking advantage of it and encouraging them to write what they want them to write, what they want to sort of proliferate. And that's the thing with Kipling, is Kipling was this empirist. But he really was kind of jingoistic and rah-rah the Empire and for the good of, you know, the world, that England should proliferate and become the center of the world and impose their empire on the rest of the world. That was, not that I've read any of these stories, but this is what I know about Kipling.
Well, and it's kind of implied in the issue as well.
Yeah.
You know what?
And it's implied that, like, everything he wrote, he did, you know, sort of for good. You know, like, I mean, he was really...
He thought he was in the right.
Right, exactly.
You know what, though? I found something extremely interesting. And after that issue, I did a little bit of research on Kipling. You know, I wanted to see what the stuff he had written and kind of his timeline and everything.
Yeah.
In his meeting with Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, I'm trying to find the exact part.
This story says he was approached by the cabal and told them to show off.
Okay, here it is.
Which
it's at the very
in that world that, like, he got to do that and still be a very successful author.
Well, this is kind of caught me very interesting. It says into here. Says here that Samuel Clemens is talking to Kipling, says, "You're a mystery to me, your laureateship." And from what I read of his history, Kipling never was poet laureate. There's
But Samuel Clemens could be using that ironically as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calling him your laureateship in a way as saying,
you're sort of a mouthpiece for your country rather
than the actual poet
laureate.
Well,
and he might even have even meant laureate of the cabal, which is what they're discussing.
That could be as well.
Mm.
It could be. That's.
But so.
Not really implied.
Just, like, the whole fact that, like, Clemens basically defied the cabal, but still had this, you know, spectacular career.
Although, the way Clemens talks about defying the cabal, I think he did it in a way where he outfoxed them a little bit.
Mm.
So it was kind of like, yeah, I know I'm a really popular writer and have a lot of power. But I'm going to come across as someone who is going to be more trouble than it's worth to mold because I'm just too folksy and things like that, you know?
The comment about the laureateship, I didn't...
Kipling, you know, he got to have the spectacular career. He became the most famous writer of his generation and everything until he defied them and all these horrible things started happening. He still is a very successful writer, though, because the Jungle Book Tales and all that, that's what he's more remembered for now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, he's actually far more popular are his...
His post-cabal. Mm-hmm. Those are the things he wrote in kind of defiance to the cabal.
Songs.
Yeah. I mean, the how so stories or whatever, is that what they're called?
Just...
Yeah, something like that.
The ones about, like, how
they quote, the guy from the cabal at the end quotes a line from,
Just Those Stories.
The line he quotes that he says is being particularly bold is from, White Man's Burden, which is one of his poems.
Well, maybe what the cabal isn't really, they're not concerned with whether or not you're a successful writer. but maybe whether...
Writing what they want you to write.
Exactly. Even if you defy them, you could still be commercially successful, but you wouldn't necessarily be happy, or the things important to you might be taken away.
You know, maybe some research into...
that the Just So stories and the Jungle Book stories, those are what spring to mind for people when you talk about Kipling. Those are what are now part of the public, you know, his legacy, rather than these other, other stuff.
But what I think...
With Twain is still, you know, he's got a huge legacy among readers and literature. So even though the Cabal was successful with Kipling at the time... Not so much afterwards.
But it depends on what the definition is. My understanding is that they didn't give a shit whether he was a successful or a well-known writer for that other stuff.
No, it's...
That wasn't their point.
What I think we're supposed to infer from this is that the things that he wrote after that, the things like the Jungle Book and...
that they were harmless?
That if we are to understand what they were about... That could kind of give a clue as to the position of the Cabal and what it is that what their operation is about. You know what I mean? If he wrote things like the Jungle Book in opposition to the Cabal, and they did not look favorably upon it, that might give us a clue as to what exactly their goals are.
Well, I mean, it seems to say like that. The themes of these stories that he was writing was the sort of David and Goliath type stories of the powerless person rising up against the big.
Well, he says here, I set aside the themes of empire and duty and told children's stories, artless tales in which small and powerless protagonists laid low bigger and more powerful aggressors.
So...
They were definitely in favor of his imperialistic stuff, but not so much the...
It almost seems to me like the content wasn't as important as the power he gave up. Like, he was no longer passionate, it was artless, like he diluted the power that he could have potentially wielded.
Back to that thing that I said about the poet laureate thing. There was a big movement and big controversy as to why he never was the poet laureate. I mean, he's British, but actually he was born in India. But I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not. When I read that, I just wondered if, due to the Cabal's influence, if and kind of the fact that fictional characters are somehow apparently coming to life or whatever, if the past was somewhat altered or the past in the comic book is not quite the same as what we know to be realistic.
It's a very subtle clue.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Who knows? I'm also interested, did Oscar Wilde actually... go to jail for sodomy?
Yes. There's a movie about it with a very young Jude Law. This is Lover.
Oh, yeah? Wild. I know of the movie,
but he went to jail. He went to, like, a very harsh work camp.
Okay.
Which basically, like, he was in there for 2 years or so, but it destroyed his health.
And they're implying the comic...
He was never as virile or happy afterwards, so...
And they're implying the comic in the comic that Kipling had something to do with that. Or indirectly, through the Cabal.
Had something to do with that.
That Kipling was not favorable of Oscar Wilde, and therefore the Cabal...
Well, it
kind of felt like the Cabal was clearing the way for Kipling. Wilde was the fashion and the style of the time.
You know, it's almost a very... It kind of makes you think of the last page, where Wilson goes in and finds Kipling's... journal, but if you look at how Kipling or how Wilson is represented, he kind of looks like a person that Kipling would not be in favor of.
Right.
You know, clearly Wilson is part of the whole '60s. He is kind of a dandy, and Kipling would be more establishment, whereas
Oscar Wilde was more of a hippie of that era. And now, so Taylor, Wilson Taylor, is following Kipling's footsteps, although he seems much more of an Oscar Wilde type.
Hmm.
That's just based on
the way he's
his dress. Yeah, the way he's dressed.
A pink scarf.
A pink scarf. But again,
of
do
the
we,
fashion.
We don't necessarily have a timeline for when he discovered this book.
No, but you can kind of
you can tell he's
guess it from
oh, yeah. Yeah.
From the way he's dressed. I mean, that's a very 1960s London look.
Okay.
Right there. And then if you think, okay, if the current... He wrote 13 books. The current time, you could guess that it's set in 2009, 2010. And the last one was written 15 years ago. So
I just noticed
know.
Something interesting.
What's
on
that?
This page where he discovers Kipling's journal. He's carrying the map around.
Well, he's carrying a tube.
He's carrying a tube on his back, which is what they started carrying.
Something rolled up with a scroll.
Yeah, which...
The map that they find in his study.
Yeah.
Seems like a logical conclusion.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's another thing that just... You know, overall about this series is I've noticed going back and looking through each page and stuff, like, there's a lot to be discovered here, and that it is incredibly dense. Like, there's a lot more writing in these issue per issue or page per page than there is in, you know, I don't think any other comic that we're reading right now.
Well, I think that's typical
of
I want to
read these books.
My Carrie.
I want to read the Tom and Taylor books. They sound great.
They do. I mean, they are definitely... Harry Potter-esque.
Well, yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. But,
but the, one of the passages where Tommy, like, opens a door to some world, and the description of it, and the, also the arc, and credit where credit's due, it's just, this world seems horrible. It's just all very interesting.
Yeah. It also seems pretty cliched, though, too. Like, there's, like, unicorns, and I don't know. It just...
Well, the
genre conventions.
People have argued that the Harry Potter books are full of cliches and that Rowling is kind of a hack. You know, but
for sure,
that didn't
sure.
stop any of us from
That's
reading
true.
Them and loving them.
That's true.
Yeah, but she actually uses those cliches to her advantage, I think.
So Florence said something just now that I think is worth noting. I know Mike wants to say something too, but when the in the fourth issue when the last of the authors is being killed by was it Pullman?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
He says something really interesting and I'm gonna try and find it.
Oh, the genre?
Yeah, he says
it's not that's actually the not the last one that he kills. It's when he kills Laurel K. Hamilton.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Is it the one with
And she's behind a curtain.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's,
so he
that's
says,
actually the second one.
So he says,
no,
you know what's guiding you, controlling you, pushing you
it
on?
Looks like
a, or I don't know. It probably starts earlier than that. It's like, okay.
He's talking about.
You know
why,
what it's like.
You know,
your brain.
No...
I'm gonna quote it.
Okay.
But you know what it's like. Your brain shuts down and you follow your instincts, or at least you think you do. But you know what you're really doing when you flee through the night or crawl through your little bolt hole. Do you know what's really guiding you, controlling you, pushing you on? And then he kills her and he says, genre conventions.
Yeah.
Which may be really telling. Like, they're saying there that genres and fiction controls reality.
Oh,
one thing that I've been...
Something we totally did not mention at all, which seems pretty important.
What's
and,
that?
The whole trumpet and prophecy aspect.
So before we move on to that, I think Mike had a point on this topic.
Well, I've been trying to get this point out for a while, and it's we're finally kind of back on topic to it, so now it's a good time to say it. But we talked about the whole genre conventions and the fandom, and the fans believing that they own a certain they have certain rights to the characters. It's interesting to note that Mike Carey, for the last 4 years, has also written one of the X-Men comics. So probably has experienced quite a bit of fanatical fandom at conventions and that, and people, yelling about what he's done to the characters.
And it's one of those things, like, people do feel like they have a certain... They're protective of certain characters they like. Like, see what people, you know, how many people get so crazy passionate about things like the X-Men or Spider-Man, or whether or not he's married, or...
Yeah.
You know.
And, well,
I remember a couple of years ago, like, there was like, this really cheesecake statue of Mary Jane that came out, and I got upset. I was like, that's not what I think of when I think of Mary Jane.
Well, it's not just the fans also, but the publishers and the editors also, who feel like they need to present a certain image from each of the characters. You hear a lot of writers that have worked on these big comics that complain they can't do exactly what they want to do because the editors say, well, no, we can't have Spider-Man in the Max book. We can't have Wolverine do something or other.
And I don't think that is completely 100% unreasonable either.
No, it's
I
not.
Mean, when you work on something that is not yours...
Mm-hmm.
Where you come in and you're an established writer. Say you're Warren Ellis, for example, and you decide, you know what? I've never written Spider-Man. I want to write Spider-Man, and now I'm going to do things to Spider-Man that no one has ever done before, and no one is really going to like. But I think it's an interesting idea.
When an editor hires a certain writer for a certain comic. They should know that they bring a certain style of
writing. I do understand that.
Grant Morrison on Astonishing X-Men.
Yeah.
Warren Ellis on Astonishing X-Men. Grant Morrison back on New X-Men.
Yep. And I do understand that.
Warren Ellis is writing Armory Wars right
now. I'm also kind of like thinking that, you know, if you're an author and you want to work on a beloved character and all this, don't piss in the sandbox. You know, if you really have this story you want to tell, and the only way you can tell it is to take an established character and put him through the ringer and do things that you know that the majority of people aren't going to like, maybe, you know, you could find a way to channel that into a character that you yourself have created.
But there are certainly times when... an editor could be seen as impeding progress of the character.
Let me put this another way. And this is, you mentioned Doctor Who, and my friend Robert has actually used this analogy when it comes to Doctor Who writers, particularly the book writers, who seem to go out of their way in the books to take former companions and torture and or kill them.
Aww.
And it's kind of like, you know what, you're playing with someone else's toys. You shouldn't break them.
Then there's the aspect of, you know, if you don't like it, don't read it.
That is also true.
Let the writer decide what they want to write, and if you hate it, just ignore it.
That is also true. And that actually kind of brings up something that happened recently with someone who created some characters for Marvel and left Marvel.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And then another writer took over those characters, did some things that this person who created these characters didn't like, and this person who had left Marvel got all confrontational on the internet saying, "Nuh-uh, that's not what these characters like."
Whatever. That's the. But
what are you talking about?
We're talking about Rob Liefeld, who created Shatterstar, which for years was a character I hated because it was like epitome of Rob Liefeld style, but then was recently outed as being, at the very least, bisexual.
By Peter David, who is a current writer of X-Factor.
Who is a very well-liked writer, except for that guy at the Source. Remember that? some guy ranted at us about Peter David when I was buying an X-Factor comic.
Was it because of the Shatterstar thing?
No, I didn't ask for details. I didn't want to know, but it was somebody behind the counter. It was rather funny.
So basically,
it was very
personal, there is.
It was like he was offended that I was buying it.
There's this whole thing about who is the one with the ownership of the characters? Is it for Spider-Man? Is it Steve Ditko? Is it Stan Lee? Is it Marvel? Is it the fans?
Well,
is it Todd McFarlane?
The funny thing is,
it's kind of all of the above.
Yeah, it is all of the above, but everybody has a different agenda.
Yep.
Obviously, editors want money, but they also want to do what they think will sell to the most people. Therefore, they have to listen to what the masses want, and, you know, masses will never agree to everything, so they have to kind of come up with a definition of what it is that they want, which, you know, usually says, okay, well, we got to keep the status quo, but we got to change it enough so that people stay interested, but we can't really make any significant changes.
But with Spider-Man, do they have to, or can they do anything and people just keep buying it?
You know,
that's the
there's
thing. Like,
overtures
that... kind of do let the writer or the artist do what they're going to do, and then you can not buy it if you don't like it.
Oh, please, these are comic fans we're talking about.
Well, and not only that, but I think to some degree that argument is bullshit, because you can't know what's going to happen before you read it. I mean, you can't
get to the point where, like, this just, I don't like this, this isn't how I, you know, feel about this character.
You don't get your money back.
I can stop buying it. That's cool, that's valid.
But that's the thing, is that you stop buying it after it's been ruined, again, in quotations, ruined for you.
Right. Well,
no one's going to stop reading it.
That's
when
only that
it.
Only applies to individual issues of a comic. I mean, you can't stop buying a book. You know, I mean, you could just
you
not
can
buy
stop
any books
the series
by
and,
that author.
You know, and anything else the author does, if it's really that much, you know, something you dislike that much.
Right. But I what I'm saying is that that is after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're essentially deciding.
I see your point, especially like things like Doctor Who books. If you buy the book and you decide, oh, I hated this. You cannot write or read it, but the person will still not be paid for that, and therefore continue to write.
Well, I think
better would be for you to write a scathing review on Amazon.
I think we've kind
and,
of.
Anne Rice will berate you for that.
Yeah, we've gone into kind of the whole catch 22 of the comics industry. You know, trying to hold on to a 40 or 50 year history. But and still preserve the characters for today's audiences.
And of course, nowadays it's completely different than it was back then because feedback can be instantaneous. And
yeah.
The author can immediately know what everyone thinks. And yeah. So what are we at? Are we at about an hour now?
Oh, it's an hour and 15.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, we don't necessarily have to get into the second argument.
I'm kind of like thinking that we've kind of pushed the boundaries.
We could have our first two-parter.
We could. We could talk about the
we
second
could,
arc.
Second, do our second one,
yeah.
Second part.
And thus, you would have time
thus,
to...
Yeah, you have time to read it.
Read it, Susie, and we get a...
And we'd have time
if
to read...
If you're going to send it to me, I will write, get right on it.
Well, and we'd also have time to read the 10th issue that
that's
comes
true.
Out
yeah,
this
but that's
week.
Starting the new arc. We want to get into
well,
the
is
new
it
arc.
Starting the new arc? Or
unless it's another...
It, the,
one or the other.
The 9th issue should, says that the it's called... they call it the conclusion of...
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Particular.
Right. So, which I don't think is bad. I mean, essentially that would allow us to, you know, speculate on this new arc and what's happened.
Which does bring up a lot of new stuff. Very intriguing.
And
I would say,
would
I will say I'm much more intrigued with the comic after the second arc than it was after the first arc.
I agree. And I'm
yep.
interested in hearing your thoughts about it, Susie. So.
Yeah, like, that makes me, because I'm totally intrigued by the first arc. So, the second arc is even more interesting than... I definitely want to read that soon.
I could have walked away from the comic after 5 issues.
Oh, no way.
But now it's I really want to know.
No, I'm totally in it after the first 5 issues, so...
Well,
yeah,
everyone at the
more.
Library is going to be very happy because I have the trade on reserve for me at the Hennepin County Library, except it actually hasn't come out yet. It's right now in pending status. I'm number one of, like, 25 on the waiting list, and now that I've read your issues, I can take
you
my
can just
off.
Cancel it.
Yeah.
This is why I can't ever find anything but the same comics at the libraries, because everyone's got them queued up.
I have maxed out my reserve list right now. that's 100 books on reserve at the Hennepin County Library System.
I just picked up the Southland Tales.
Oh, yeah?
Trades, not knowing that there was a movie that either they were based on or they were based on the movie.
They're tied together somehow. I'm not sure how it works.
Wait.
Or something like that.
Southland Tales, that's the one by the same director as the one where the airplane engine
Donnie
crashes.
Darko?
Yeah, Donnie Darko.
Yeah, I know.
So you have
the
comics
the
right now? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I want to read those.
All right.
I'm pretty sure they're the prequel to
Well, we've kind of lost Florence.
I've never seen the movie. Never really knew about the movie. I know it's got The Rock in it. That's all I know.
Florence has left the room.
Yeah,
she
left kind of clutching her belly, and I hope she's okay.
So maybe we should wrap it up.
Let's stop the podcast and take care of that.
And we'll come back in not too long with part two of our talking about The Unwritten.
Yeah.
The unpodcasted.
Now, and I don't think that should necessarily be our next book club.
No,
we
not
can
necessarily.
We can discuss this off.
Yeah. So, okay.
All right. Goodbye.
Yeah,
bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening.